The Bradshaw Arts Hour on Wandsworth Radio, where you listen with your ears and not your mouth.
Good evening, and welcome to the Bradshaw Arts Hour on Wandsworth Radio. My name's Aisha, and I'll be with you for the next hour up until 7 o'clock. And this evening, in the studio with me, I have Vicky Weston, who is a new voice on the Bradshaw Arts Hour.
Hello, everybody, and welcome.
And I also have Matt with me again this week, who is going to be doing a review very shortly. First up, though, I'm going to run through what we've got coming up in the show. This week we've got quite a bit of poetry to get through from a wonderful man called Owen Collins, which is really exciting to hear some new kind of stuff. We haven't done any poetry yet. We're also going to be listening to a review from Ellie of a play that she saw a couple of weeks ago called Taken at Midnight. And we're also going to hear an interesting essay by a good friend of mine called Corey Holes and his take on Spider-Man and how awful Spider-Man is. But first up, we are
the Matt Boothman Film Review. So good, I put my trousers back on.
Hi, Matt.
Evening. So I'm going to talk about Whiplash this week.
Yeah.
And I sort of teased this last week, and we know that you haven't seen it because it's full of jazz drumming.
Yeah, definitely not going to see this one. I'm sorry. I cannot offer you anything.
So the movie in brief is it stars Miles Teller as a guy called Andrew Neyman, who's just starting at the most prestigious music college in the United States. It's a fictional one, Schaefer Conservatory. And he's there with one purpose. He wants to be the best jazz drummer of all time. Small dreams. And he manages to get curry favour with an infamous sort of star maker / teacher / band conductor, Fletcher, played by J.K. Simmons. And so everything seems to be going great. Fletcher seems to be being friendly and encouraging of his talent, seems to have spotted him and sort of picked him out of the band that he was in and put him in his own band, which is all very encouraging. But everything starts to, the alarm bells start to ring quite quickly. First alarm bell, there are no women in Fletcher's band, and he supposedly sort of handpicked this whole band from all the other bands in the whole school. Second alarm bell comes when he's been very encouraging and sort of, oh, we'll go at your pace, you know, just show us what you can do. But then as soon as Miles Teller's character's not quite going at his tempo, he has to stop. Everything has to stop. He has to keep, and it starts to turn out that Fletcher is a monster. He's a complete monster.
Oh dear!
So he's
taking a turn very quickly.
And so we get into this quite quickly in the movie, and we start to see his techniques and how he quote unquote teaches or sort of nurtures new talent, which is sort of variously verbal abuse, a lot of which is homophobic. And you start to see why there are no women in the band. He sort of equates femininity with weakness. Physical abuse. He slaps Miles Teller's character when he's going too slow or too fast. He throws chairs around the room. Humiliation tactics. So he's sort of making you play everything again and again and again until you get it exactly at the tempo that he's going. Playing mind games and introducing competition within the band. So there are sort of the core players and the sort of the second chair players who sort of sit there turning the pages for the core players while and then occasionally get a go. And so he brings in new people and sort of suggests that they might get a core seat in order to produce competition to try and encourage people to do better, playing all the members of the band off against each other. And I thought this might make quite an interesting discussion, considering that sort of we're all creative people in this room who've kind of worked with ensembles before, and because it in the context of the movie, all these techniques that Fletcher's using actually kind of get results.
So they work.
His band actually does well. Miles Teller's character practices harder and harder and harder than he maybe would have done if he hadn't been treated this way.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to get an idea of sort of what do we think about these as
tools,
motivation techniques, and ways of getting people to do art better.
Yeah, well, Vicky and I were speaking about it, having seen the trailer for this film and sort of understanding a little bit of what it's about, because I just see the main character yelling, and to me, we were sort of discussing the fact that in what we do, it wouldn't work. Not at the level that we are at, and I don't think that it is a very effective tool, because if you think about the industry that we're in and the arts industry as a whole, it should be a supportive, nurturing sort of space to be in. You shouldn't feel like you're really anxious all the time because people are going to yell at you because you're not creatively doing the right thing. So I don't think that it would be a very useful tool at all. If I was going to put it into practice, I couldn't do it myself.
I am the least competitive person on the planet.
And see, I'm very competitive.
I can't be encouraged to do anything by competition because I'm naturally rebellious. And if somebody tries to make me compete with someone, it is my instinct to be as amiable to that other person, as supportive as possible. And I wasn't brought up to be competitive by my parents. It was all very much about taking part. And that's always been my approach to pretty much everything that I do.
Mm.
And I think that there has always been an assumption that if you push people really hard and you drive people really hard, you get results, and that would work in any scenario. And I know that there are certain gyms that you can go to where you basically get verbally abused by an instructor to work harder. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And they call the sessions kind of like drill sergeant or boot camp. And the idea is that you kind of go and get sort of faux bullied into getting fitter and healthier. And for some people, that seems to really help drive them.
I think that's the thing. It is a very individual thing that can only work for a certain type of character and a certain type of person. Because like you were saying, if someone said to me, I would not do very well if I was, you know, being told and abused to, you know, do more push-ups. That's not going
to
work.
If I'm being told to do something or kind of, you know, verbally abused, or if I'm even aware I'm being manipulated into doing something, it's my instinct to just stop doing it, even if it's something that I wanted to do in the first place. So I know that Fletcher's technique certainly wouldn't work for me, but actually I think I'm not suggesting that it's an approach that I would ever use myself. But I imagine there are some people that would say, yes, but I get results by doing this. But I think that there is always this risk that if you are pushing people to their very limit, that you will break them. And if you break someone who is creative, or any person who's trying to reach a kind of end result, then really what have you achieved? And
yeah,
the answer
exactly
is nothing.
And so Fletcher's take on this is, he traces all of his techniques back to this possibly apocryphal story about how Charlie Parker, the great jazz musician, was playing not playing to the best of his ability or better than anyone else had ever played, and another jazz musician, Joe Jones, threw a cymbal at his head, and that gave him the motivation to go away and sort of come back a year later, having practiced and practiced and practiced, and had suddenly blossomed into this amazing jazz musician. And his view is certainly that everyone in his band is expendable, as long as he manages, through his sort of humiliation and abuse techniques, to create one genius like Charlie Parker. And that is his goal in life. He's not really acting like a teacher. He's acting more like he sees himself as more of a kind of a talent spotter. Like he has this speech where he says that it's all justified because a Charlie Parker would never be discouraged, no matter how heavily he abused that person. So that's his justification. And it all, within the movie, it all stands up. It all feels like it makes perfect sense because you're sucked into his logic, and he's just relentless about it. And Naaman, Miles Teller's character, is completely seduced by it, completely buys into it. And so, Vicky, like you were saying, you know, my instinct in this would be to walk away. And I'm sort of mentally yelling at Miles Teller's character throughout the movie. Just don't play his game. You know, walk away and recognise that the game is rigged, and walk out of the game and sort of set your own victory conditions and don't try to meet his. But instead, he does try to meet Fletcher's victory conditions the whole way through. It makes sense within the movie, but as soon as you sort of step away and get out of that kind of vacuum of his own of his charisma and his anger, you start to see it for what it is. It's kind of that, it's that abuser, classic abuser defense that, oh, I'm doing this for your own good. And then you start thinking about, is he actually looking for greatness? What is he actually after? Because if it's greatness, and if it's the next Charlie Parker that he's after, is this what he's going to get through these techniques, or is he just going to get somebody who is completely obedient to his every whim? So what he's actually going to end up with through these techniques, I feel like, is sort of a jazz band full of emotionless jazz robots who live in fear and who respond beautifully to his every tiny movement of his hand while he's conducting, but who aren't necessarily listening to each other and sort of feeling the music.
And that's an interesting point, though, as well, because that's not what jazz is supposed to be. I don't know a huge amount about jazz, but the one thing that I do know is that you need to be really free, and you need to, you know, have complete creative control and be given complete creative control. And it doesn't sound like a very good jazz band if you're trying to, you know, mold these people into exactly what they need to be.
I think any type of creative endeavour is that combination of discipline and creativity. And it's like he is, my understanding from what you've been telling us, Matt, is he's trying to almost, he's kind of frightened by their creative thinking, by their own innovation, by their own free thinking, which is really what creativity is, I believe. And so he's crushing that out of them. So he's getting the perfectly disciplined musician without any of the creativity, so that his creativity is allowed to sing. And that gives him the kind of, you know, and I think that is common with creative teachers, that you get, a sense of, this is my prodigy, this is my student, this is my creation, and you're the creator of somebody who creates, and that somehow, you know, just makes you the centre of attention still, even though you're supposed to be giving, you know, creativity to others.
Yeah, I do feel like it is all about him for him in the end. He doesn't necessarily want to create the new... Having the new Charlie Parker in the world isn't necessarily his end game. It's being the person who created that great jazz musician, and so his end game is this sort of nightmarish band of jazz robots. And but it's interesting. So I am going to talk quite briefly about the end of the movie now, so fair warning about that. But it's interesting that you say about sort of the freedom and the creativity, because the end game for Naaman, for Miles Teller's character, is that he does finally wrest back control by going off on, Aisha, again, another thing you would hate, he goes off on a 6-minute drum solo.
Oh, so long.
He sort of he basically steals control away from Fletcher and does what he wants on the stage and expresses himself. But it's not quite a happy ending, because it's kind of that by doing that, he earns Fletcher's respect as somebody else who doesn't care about anybody else's feelings and will do what he wants. And so you just end up with sort of the two of them. It's this clash of male egos thing again, mm-hmm. that you get a lot at the Oscars. And you just feel like the two of them butting heads throughout the whole movie just throw the entire rest of the ensemble under the bus. So it's a fantastically tense movie, and I do like jazz, and there's a lot of great music in it. I really like sort of Caravan and a lot of those other tracks. So it is a really enjoyable movie, but it's very tense, and it whether you enjoy it will come down to just sort of how much you align with that Fletcher character on what you think creativity ought to be.
It's an interesting, I think it's a really interesting film. Yeah, looking at an issue that is quite interesting, but I can say now that I couldn't sit through it. you've really tried, Matt, and I really do appreciate you sort of, you know, doing these great reviews and trying to, you know, get me along to see a film, but it's not going to happen.
I will definitely be seeing it, I can. But I was already, it was already on my list of things that I need to see, partly because I'm also kind of a bit of a jazz fan, but also because I just think J.K. Simmons is an incredible actor, and it just looks like the role of a lifetime for him.
And I've never seen him in a non-comic role before.
No, he's normally a dad, isn't he? Yeah. So.
All right. Thanks so much for that review, Matt. That's fantastic. Can you tell us what you're doing next week? Do you know?
I've got a few choices next week. Ooh. So I might do Big Hero 6.
Okay.
I might do Inherent Vice.
Fantastic.
There's a couple of other things out as well. It's quite a good time for movies.
Oh, yes,
so,
it is.
So yeah. I don't know. It'll be a surprise next week. Or if anyone wants to tweet me at Matt Boothman, tell me what I ought to review for next week.
Yes, and if you want to tweet into the show at Blackshore Update or go onto our Facebook page and like us, then please do that. Now we're changing it up a little bit this week. We're doing some poetry. I'm going to play about six poems by Owen Collins. He's been involved with Blackshore at a few different levels. The most recently, he was at New Writing Night, which is the first time that I'd seen him do his poetry. I've seen him around quite a lot at different New Writing Nights. But I saw him do his poetry and it was fantastic. And after that, I accosted him after the show and said, I want to record everything you have. And he looked really scared. But still said yes to recording, which was really lovely of him. So this is a poem called Related to Love.
This is a poem called Related to Love. There's a popular online rhyming dictionary, which is a bit rubbish. But as when you search for a word, as well as giving you like two words that rhyme with that word, it will give you a list of words related to it. And for some reason, a couple of months ago, I was trying to find rhymes for the word love, beyond the obvious, sort of glove and shove and dove. And then I noticed the list of words related to love, and it was about 500 words long. With some interesting words that you wouldn't necessarily relate to love. And so I wrote them all into a poem. So it's not really something I've written, but I've sort of put it together. It is an Airfix kit poem, in a way. This is called Related to Love. Abandoned, absence, absolutely, abuse, abyss, accept, addiction, alcohol, ambition, and America, always amazing, Andrew and Andrea, angels, animals, anniversary, anxious, annoying, anything, apathy, art, arts, ash, ashes, ashamed, Asian, assurance and ass, bad back, baby, bananas and baseball, balcony, beautiful, barred, bear and bags, cupid, crying, cloves and coffee, coke and college and comedy, cheap cheese and chicken and communication, Christmas, companionship, concentration, colours and cowboys and complication, cum and cream and copulation, dancing and dreaming and damage and darkness, deception, depression, death and divorce, dinner and diamonds, devotion, discover, drama and destiny and ducks. Of course. Erotic, eclipse, fidelity, fiction, gangsters, garages, hockey and history, impossible, innocence, justice and jungle, kissing and kingdom, learning and longing, magician and marathon, matrix and memory, Mills, miles, mistresses, mint and mystery, nervous and nude, not normal and nuts, oasis and opium, orgasm, ouch, people, perfection, penguins, poetry, ponies, protection, questions and quality, racism, radio, records, rejection, romantic rhetoric, revenge and reflection, Shakespeare, silence, sugar and spice, skateboards and shoulders and students and skies, sunrise, sunset, Sunday, sun, somebody, someday, somewhere, someone, touching togetherness through thunder and tide, unique, undying, understanding, unite, victory and vanity, values and violence, victims and virgins and vixens, vaginas, winter, wind and wet weather, warm and warmth and whiskey and wine, years and yesterday, zero and zone, happiness, everything, yours and mine.
That was a poem called Related to Love by Owen Collins. That's my favourite poem of his, only because it's so basic in it's just words.
It really gallops along, doesn't it?
It gallops along, and you think about the fact that those words were just on a website and they are all somehow related to love, and some of them are mad.
Yeah.
I don't understand.
Ducks. What?
Ducks. And, yeah, really, really bizarre things. But, yeah, that is my favourite poem. The next poem we've got coming up is called The Risk of Risk, and it's about the game Risk, which I know nothing about. And when we recorded this, Owen actually had to explain it to me. He explains it in the intro to this poem, actually, as well, but I've never played it. Have you played it, Vix, Matt?
Yeah.
Risk?
Nope.
You've never played Risk?
No.
I played Risk once and it was so boring.
Really?
Yeah, I did not like it.
Owen loves it.
No, I'm not a fan. I like Cluedo.
Yeah.
So much more drama.
Cluedo is fun. Because I've played the Game of Life before and I got a bit confused. I thought Risk was the Game of Life. I don't think
it's... like an English version of the Game of Life.
Well, maybe. I don't know. All your people, you love board games,
oh,
don't
we do.
You? Yeah.
Yeah, we do.
See, we don't really have that much in
They're
Australia
going
because
a
we have.
Yes,
yeah.
They really have.
I think it's got something to do with your weather, definitely. We have better weather in Australia, so we don't have to sit around playing board games. Anyway, this is a poem by Owen Cole. It's called The Risk of Risk.
This is about the board game Risk, which I enjoy a lot. I don't know if any of you listening play Risk. It's a board game, and it's a map of the world that's divided into several territories, a lot of which have got slightly dubious names, like Yakutsk. And you get a certain amount of territories to start off with, and you basically have to conquer the world. And the best bit isn't the actual playing, it's the making alliances with other players against other players, and just generally creating all-around bad feeling. And you have to set aside a few hours after each game of Risk to just sort of sit in silence and repair your friendships, because everyone will be too furious with each other to actually talk or do anything. I played a game of Risk in 2011 with a friend of mine called Luke, and we're still not quite as friendly as we were before that, ever since he betrayed me in East Congo. But that's fine, you live and learn. But yeah, played it with my girlfriend a few times, often with my family as well. And as much as I love my girlfriend, and I should clarify this now, when I play Risk with the girlfriend, I have a horrible habit of going for her first. And I don't know why. Maybe it's because she knows my weaknesses and I need to get her out of the game. And often I will sort of form an alliance with my brother, and we will together wipe her out quite quickly. Like, my mum's fine, because my mum is a very ineffectual player who doesn't really know what she's doing, so we can leave her till the end. But yeah, we have to get rid of my girlfriend first. So this is a poem about how... well, it's called The Risk of Risk, and it's just about how the sort of relationship-destroying powers of the game Risk. The Risk of Risk. I love you, really, my darling, my dear, though that doesn't mean I'll give you Siberia. I fear our relationship as mutual lovers may be undermined by my alliance with my brother. It's nothing personal, we're just trying to keep you out of Central Africa. And after that, I promise I'll attack him with all my horses to win you back, because to me, you see, you're all that matters. Although Ural and Yakutsk, they're mine, okay? And I know I would be a romantic failure if I didn't let you have Western Australia. I know you'd return the presents I gave you if I'm not your saviour in Scandinavia. Thing is, my number of troops is limited, and if I conquer North America, I get an extra 5. So it's worth wiping you out to keep my dreams alive of territorial expansion. And when I rule the continents, I'll buy you a mansion, and all the cannons in Asia couldn't keep us apart. And I'll roll a 6 to launch a cavalry charge on your heart.
Okay, these are fantastic, and they're so funny. I'm sorry.
We're all just
giggling in the studio, and I've heard them many times before. It was actually, recording with Owen the other night was probably one of the funnest recordings I've ever done, because he's so funny, and, yeah, he just rambles. We've cut these intros. These intros to these poems were so long. Big props to our sound guy, Andy, actually, for getting through it. The next poem we've got coming up is called Hydrocatch, which has a fantastic introduction, which it needs, because I'm not really sure if anyone actually knows what a hydrocatch is.
Nope.
It's got to do with swimming pools and water slides. So here you go.
My favourite word currently in the English language is hydrocatch. I'm not even sure it's a proper word, but I saw it on a sign at Butlins once. In the swimming pool, Butlin's Minehead, and in the swimming pool they have several hydro catches, which wasn't... I'd always wondered if there was a name for it. It's that bit at the end of a long water slide. It's always longer than it needs to be, and you always think, oh, if I pick up a load of speed going down the slide, I'll get right to the end, and you never do. You barely get halfway through. It's just like the big sort of trough of water that you sort of land in at the end of a slide. Yeah, so there's this kind of... It's quite cool, because they're slightly deeper than you think. They're slightly choppier than you expect, just because of all the water coming down. It's kind of a bit of a current. And so there is a slight sense of panic that you've got to get yourself out before the next person comes down, even though the lifeguards won't send the next one down until you're out. But it's still quite a kind of exciting experience, the hydrocatch. and it's, you know, it's not a very popular word. As I say, I'm not sure it's a proper word, but I thought I'd write it into a poem. So that one day, in a sort of like Oxford English Dictionary, they might say, oh yeah, first used in Owen Collins' poem, Hydrocatch, like first recorded use. And I'll say, no, it was on a sign at Butlins, but secretly be quite pleased. So, last summer, me and my girlfriend went to Centre Parks. Yeah, and they have a lot of cool water slides there of a sort of lagoon, several with their own hydro catch. And I sort of said, as my girlfriend was just heading down the water slide, wait for me in the hydro catch, which seemed like a good opening line to a poem. So judge for yourselves. This is called Hydro Catch. Wait for me in the hydro catch, my love, in our oasis while the condensation rains down from above. Beside the coruscating foam, beneath the temperature-controlled dome, in our subtropical home from home, wait for me in the hydrocatch, my love. Wait for me in the hydrocatch, my love, and imagine the seabirds swirling around us like doves. As the lifeguard looks on with panache, and the wave machine begins to crash, stay to see the size of my splash, and wait for me in the hydrocatch, my love. Wait for me in the hydrocatch, my love. Linger where the water alternates from calm to rough. I will flail down the flume, head first, feet first, I will zoom in order to get back to you, so wait for me in the hydrocatch, my love. Wait for me in the hydrocatch, my love. Avoid the rapids where the unruly bathers thump and shove. For the looping slides will bring me back, for the joins give you a stingy back, so before you take your dinghy back, wait for me in the hydrocatch, my love.
That was an educational poem by Owen Collins about what a hydrocatch is. Do we all know now?
Yeah,
up
I feel
to speed.
Illuminated.
Yeah, my vocabulary has expanded.
It's fantastic.
I really hope it is an actual word, because I feel like it's necessary, because what else do you call it? Like, I don't know what I've been calling it for the last 27 years.
I'm still not quite sure what it is, to be honest. I've not been to a swimming pool or somewhere with water slides for a very, very long time.
I think it's
I've
just
never
that,
been
yeah,
to a Butlins.
Just like the bit at the end. You don't ever want to go to a Butlins.
No.
I haven't either, but that was giving me Centre Parks nostalgia.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to Centre Parks in April, so I'm excited to go back to the Hydro Catch.
If anyone sees Owen or decides to accost him after a new writing night, I would highly suggest that you ask him about the time that his German teacher kicked him in the back at a at a water slide, because I got that full story when we did that recording, and it was a very long story. It was a very funny story, very, very long-winded, but went completely perfectly with that particular poem. So yeah, ask him about his German teacher kicking him in the back. It's a good story. The next poem that we have by Owen coming up is it's a bit different to the ones that we've just played. The subject matter is a little bit heavier. It's called Free Muhammad Al-Ajimi, and here it is.
Brief bit of context. It's a poem about a poet called Muhammad Al-Ajimi, who wrote a poem about the Arab Spring in 2011, I think. And generally said it was, you know, a good idea to overthrow corrupt dictators. And so Qatar, where he's from, which has a special corrupt dictator of its own, threw him in jail for 15 years. And I think that's a little bit unfair. To put it mildly. This is called Free Muhammad Al-Ajimi. The pen is mightier than the sword, or at least that's what I was told, and sticks and stones may break my bones, but a government can't be overthrown by just the power of words alone. Or can it? No, it can't. But even if you think it can, that is no excuse for jailing a man who can do no harm apart from cause alarm with his call to arms. It's not the poem that makes the difference, it's not the song, be it yours or Bob Dylan's, because everything hinges on the person that listens. They're the one that will change the world, not the one who spoke, the one who heard. By writing, by singing, we're planting a seed for the minds of the ones who can listen and read. And once they've got the message, they plant one of their own, and before anyone can stop it, the idea has grown. And from that call to arms alone, we're more powerful than any sticks or stones. Until that is the one on the throne, decides what's being said is inflammatory, decides to change the record and start a different story, decides what the people can or can't hear, what they can or can't say. And this king, this emir, this sultan, this prime minister or this president plays God with the language and sets their own precedent. But the world has 7 billion writers in residence, and no one has the power to silence them all. So if we all shout together, then the tyrants will fall. But already the kangaroo court is in session to deal out repression to our freedom of expression, and how have we so quickly forgotten the lesson that was taught to us by Pussy Riot? If you won't treat us equal, then you can't keep us quiet. Muhammad Al-Ajami, wife and four kids, and now a life sentence for a poem he did in which his biggest crime was to say what he thought of the Arab Spring, to express his support, and it's earned him 15 years in jail as reward. But let the world know he will not be forgotten as he spends his life in a prison cell rotting. For those willing to use it, we still have a voice, and for those with a voice, that gives us the choice to speak out against injustice wherever we see it, to fight corruption and never to flee it. And when they ask what gives us the right to take on dictators, autocrats and tyrants, we'll show them our poetic license, because from Cairo to Russia, London to Harare, in the face of repression, we are all Qatari. It could be you, it could be me, it could be prose or music or poetry, and if the ruling classes don't like what we say, then them, because we'll say it anyway. For we have the freedom to say what we like, a freedom to be heard, a freedom to strike, and the freedom to think, to speak, to write is more than just poetry. It's a human right.
You're listening to Poetry by Owen Collins on the Blackshaw Arts Hour. That was a poem called Free Muhammad Al-Ajami, and we've all seen that a few times live. I think it's very good to see Owen do that live, because he does, it's a very passionate poem, and it's nice to see him standing being passionate by a microphone and getting really into it.
And 7 billion writers in residence is such a lovely turn of phrase. Yeah.
It's wonderful. Fantastic. It's my favourite. It's really, really good. And it's just that reminder that, you know, everyone's got a voice and everyone's got a right to speak, and that's quite a powerful thing.
Yeah, no, it's a beautifully written poem. The next one that we have coming up is the last one that we'll be playing in this section. It is called TFL Love Haiku, and it is very, very short.
His next poem is called TFL Love Haiku, although I'm not very good at haiku, so instead of being 5 syllables, 7 syllables and 5 syllables, it's 5 syllables, 5 syllables and 7 syllables, but that's close enough. Their love was like the London Underground, increasingly contactless.
And that's that. That's quick.
So perfect.
It's beautiful, isn't it? I actually, the first time I heard it, I really had to think about it. I was like, what? Oh, that's funny.
Yeah. When I use my Oyster card tomorrow to go to work, I'm going to...
Think about all the love that's been fading out of your life every time you touch it on.
It's a horrible, horrible thought.
Yeah. But how good is contactless, though? Come on.
It is excellent.
You can't really. You can't slam it too much.
So convenient.
It's changed my life. It's changed how I live my life. It's beautiful. Coming up right now, I've got a essay to play for you by a writer who I know quite well. His name is Corey Hulls. He's also Australian, like I am. And this is an essay he's written that is quite slating towards Spider-Man as a character, as a written character, as a film character, as a character, you know, all-encompassing.
I sense I'm going to have something to say about this.
You might do, Matt, and you might not agree with everything that he says. I do somewhat, but the full title of this particular essay is "With Great Power Comes Great Responsibility, But How the Hell Would You Know? Why Spider-Man is the Worst Superhero of All Time and What This Means for the Future of the Human Race."
There are many reasons I don't like Spider-Man, but primarily I do not enjoy the character because I stopped being spoon-fed at age 12. Let's just leave that issue for my therapists / alcohol, or for the superhero I created as a child, telemarketing man, who would consistently be on hand to call at opportune times to distract the evil, overbearing mother when the young boy was overwhelmed and hopelessly outgunned. But I digress. I should make it clear, first of all, that I'm a massive fan of metaphor, double entendre, and other fantastic humorous storytelling devices. But the writers of Spider-Man really decided that opaque was not really an opinion they wanted for people trying to ascertain the illusions when creating this basically redundant character. And thus is the character's fatal flaw. Many comic book characters are richly drawn, interesting microcosms of a specific subset of society, and also a metaphor for an interesting, rich part of the world that they protect, which not only makes them ultimately fallible, but makes them all the more relatable and interesting characters. Batman, for me, not only represents the propulsive and all-consuming nature of loss, but also an ideal and not existent model of the perfect capitalist. A man who is of extreme wealth, who identifies not with the morality of religion, but the ideals of morality itself. He feels an unbreakable bond to where he is from and identifies deeply with every single person within the town, despite their flaws. He is aware of society and the need for keeping up appearances due to the issues within society, but will never compromise his values or his goals in doing so. Batman is a fantastic character, and depending on how you feel about the character, you can apply any metaphor within reason to the character, as he is just so richly drawn. Spider-Man, to me, is the worst superhero in the world for the selfsame reason. I would not argue that the character is not relatable, but I would argue that it is in fact this hyper-relatability that paradoxically makes him less of a superhero and more of a reflection of the human race's seemingly hyper-willing nature to accept normality. Bruce Wayne simply does not exist in society, but I went to school with 250 Peter Parkers. The defining line in the first movie was of course uttered by Uncle Ben when he stated that with great power comes great responsibility. It's a great line when said to a US president who's just received the nuclear codes, or to the CEO of Goldman Sachs or Bear Stearns who's getting ready to liquidate mortgage-backed securities and, in effect, begin the financial crisis. However, when said to Spider-Man, to me, it just doesn't make sense. Because Spider-Man does not represent great power. He represents me and every male I went to school with, and the only power we had was the small amount of amorousness we were provided with by our liberal use of Lynx deodorant. To outline this further, it is clear Spider-Man represents all teenage boys, and I can't think of a single subset of society with less power in the world. Sure, Spider-Man is a teenage boy in his origin story, but I feel like he remains in perpetual adolescence throughout all of his stories, directly because of the quite frankly disgusting metaphor drawn out by those who created the comic. Let's examine this even further. Petey Parker was a skinny, small boy until one day he started to notice his neighbour Mary, and then he was bitten by something that made his body much harder than it used to be. When he got excited or angry or wanted to impress his new girlfriend, he shot this new white web stuff out of his hands that has only begun to start happening as recently as his body begun changing. And his best friend's dad isn't a chill dude and tries to turn his best bud against Peter Parker, so he obviously is the most evil person in the world. For a long, long time, the single highest earning single weekend movie of all time had a story that specifically mirrored something I learned about in health class from a bored and embarrassed physical education teacher. The plot details are almost exactly the same, although I do believe during my pubescence my aunt was never kidnapped while reciting the Lord's Prayer by a flying goblin. We really don't talk that often, so I'd have to phone her for a confirmation either way. What baffles me even more about Spider-Man's popularity is that Spider-Man is intrinsically aware of both his own adolescence and complete uselessness as a superhero. I recently heard an interview with a comic book fan, someone who attempted to frame this as a positive, whereby they described a specific issue where Spider-Man was outmatched against an opponent, which basically means the opponent was over 5'4" and had scissors, and resorted to running around and telling stupid, infantile jokes. When his opponent eventually got annoyed and asked what he was doing, Spider-Man remarked, "Can't you see? I'm getting to you, I'm annoying you, I'm distracting you." Spider-Man's secret weapon was acting like a child in the back of a long car trip. If I did that as a child, I didn't get any minties. Eventually, Spider-Man's post at the top of the superhero film earnings tree was usurped by a ragtag group. A suit of high-tech armor, a science experiment gone wrong, an archer, a Russian Catwoman ripoff, a completely out-of-place god of Greek myth, and a soldier from the 1940s who just can't seem to wrap his head around them darn Kardashians. Aside from having both the same studio copyright and also a seemingly universal lack of forethought and forward planning, which then results in a subsequent need to consistently retaliate or avenge due to this, everyone in this group is without doubt a superhero, and the public's obsession in them is understandable. But in what world is it acceptable that after 3 films about the Spider-Man, less than a pubescence later, the world is subjected to a reboot of this character? I naturally assume that people would give these films the same distance they give a spectacularly drunk man coming home on the tube with a kebab as large as his torso. I went on with my life assuming they didn't exist, and was literally astonished to note that the 2 films so far have made almost $1.5 billion US, with another film to come. This, to me, speaks volumes about not only the current state of Hollywood, but also humanity. We are much more welcome to accept something that is familiar, easy, and unchallenging. Vanilla. Spider-Man is a big bowl of vanilla ice cream before the Big Bang Theory. A catchy song with a hook you've heard before, or for most people, lived through before. This means that instead of feeling inspired by these now synonymous movies, people who see Spider-Man are merely comforted by the existence of Spider-Man, and by the thought that somewhere, in some parallel universe, heroism and mediocrity are one and the same. You could argue that I am being unfairly harsh against Spidey, or that my identification with the subject matter perhaps skews it negative due to my own personal experiences. If, of course, my interpretation of the metaphor is to be accepted as truth. But I still believe it is essential that in everything humanity does, the further the world splits apart, that we have superheroes in both fact and fiction to pull it back together again. And I have a funny feeling that we are going to need something a little stronger than web jizz to do it.
That was Corey Hull's essay talking about Spider-Man and how he's actually the worst. In Corey's opinion, of course. I'm not really sure what the other opinions in the room are of Spider-Man. I don't think that I have a very strong one. So I'm going to pass it over to Matt.
So that was well argued, and I can't argue back with a lot of that. Other than I'm not sure why Corey's so confused that Spider-Man is so popular, or I think he's the biggest selling Marvel comic. At least.
Is he actually?
Yeah, he shifts more units than anyone else. I don't know about the films. I don't know how successful they've been, but he certainly shifts more comics.
More than Batman.
More than Batman.
See, I prefer Batman much more than Spider-Man.
But the thing is that Batman is a sort of a billionaire corporate head, and.
Yeah.
You can see how...
It's the relatability.
Yeah, more people can relate to somebody who has to run three jobs to make ends meet on top of superheroing.
Yeah.
And also that teenage boys have a lot of disposable income. So if you're going to make a superhero that is the avatar of the teenage boy, then it's no surprise that it sells well, I guess.
Yeah. I suppose that's fair enough. I've never been a massive fan of Spider-Man myself. I find him quite boring.
If he'd ripped into the X-Men, then I'd have something really to say.
Oh, of course. No one... Who doesn't like the X-Men?
I think my only feeling on Spider-Man is that the new movies are considerably better than the original set, in my opinion.
Remind me what the original set is. Is that Tobey Maguire?
It is Tobey Maguire.
And they are awful.
They are awful, yeah. Especially in Spider-Man 3, I think it is, where Tobey Maguire becomes a sort of bad Spider-Man, and I think it was supposed to be bad in an edgy way, but it's actually bad in a rubbish way.
I'd say that the first two of those were very good when they came out. They were good for their time.
They were
the first of that new rash of superhero movies, but I watched them again quite recently and they do not hold up.
No. I think the visuals are not very good when he's going.
And I think there's just, when there's so much competition out there, the superhero movie is such a big thing now that actually the quality's got to be pretty high to be able to
You're competing with the Avengers now, yeah. I mean, yeah. Come on.
And Andrew Garfield and Emma Stone have got much more chemistry than Tobey Maguire and Kirsten Dunst ever had.
Well, yeah. Bless him.
Tobey Maguire.
Bless him for trying, though.
You can't really ask too much of Tobey Maguire. He is essentially just everyone that you've ever known at school, really.
Especially in those films.
Yeah, that's what I think of Tobey. We're gonna talk a little bit about what's coming up with Blackshaw now. At the moment, we're going pretty hard into character. Character's got its run coming up at the Tristan Bates on the dates. I think it's May.
No, March.
It's March.
It's March.
It's Vicky's, March.
Vicky's checking getting, so that we get it absolutely right.
I'm getting it confused
is
because
from Monday the 9th until Saturday the 14th of March
at the Tristan Bates.
And tickets are
tickets
already
are
on sale. Yes,
they are on sale. So we're going to be bringing you some interviews with the cast from Character in the next coming weeks of the Blackshaw Arts Hour. So you'll get to have a little bit of an insider knowledge, I suppose, talking to the two girls that are involved in that production. Ellie's directing that as well. We'll probably talk to her about that soon.
Yeah.
We're talking now. We're going sort of seamlessly into Vicky's art thing of the week. It's a thing.
So for those of you on listening who don't know who I am, I work for Blackshaw Theatre and I do lots of different things for the company. I've been with the company since it was founded. I support the director, Ellie, in lots of different endeavours, but I mostly do all of our kind of like planning of activities because I love making lists. So
she's the most organised person in the world.
Yeah. Well, no, actually, Ellie does have me beat on many different aspects of organisation, but when it comes to getting stuff done, I will make that happen.
You're the man.
I will fix things. I'm doing a segment that we're currently calling Art Thing of the Week. It's not very catchy, so obviously if anyone's got a better idea for a title...
tweet us, please, at
By all means, tweet us at Blackshire Update.
I think the thing with the title is, I mean, it is doing what it's doing.
Yeah,
we're not pretending it's doing anything other than being the arts thing of the week, so I think it's quite fitting. Anyway.
Yeah, it's broad, and that's the way we'd like to keep it.
Yeah, if anybody does want to come up with a new one, it's got to cover all sorts of the arts.
Everything. And this week is no exception. So the question that I'm asking is really, what happens when you take something commonly found at children's birthday parties and make it for grown-ups and then make it free to get in? And the answer to this question is that everyone wants to go. And you might have missed this story last week, but creative agency Pearl Fisher, you can Google them, it's pretty interesting, they describe themselves as a future-focused independent design agency. Make of that what you will. They've had the most incredible brainwave, and it is incredible. They have created a ball pit, like from children's play areas, for adults. You've heard me. A ball pit for grown-ups only. And the way they've made it for grown-ups, rather than... the distinction between it being for children and for grown-ups is twofold. One, the balls are a nice, clean, minimalist white instead of the standard primary colour clash that makes everything child-friendly. And number two, it's in a big white room that they've called a gallery, which, of course, makes it much more closely related to the Turner Prize-winning Martin Creed's Room Full of White Balloons rather than something you'd find at Play Zones R Us, since... since the news was reported in The Independent just on Thursday, they've had over 3,000 requests for tickets, which, given that it's actually only open until the 13th of February and it's only open 10 till 5 p.m. and you can only have 30 people at a time, means that they have not got enough room for everybody.
They don't have enough balls.
They have 81,000 balls.
That is quite a lot.
It's a lot of balls.
I suspect they'll have fewer by the time they close.
Yes, people are definitely taking one home with them, aren't they? Oh, it's just a no-brainer. It doesn't cost anything to go, which is a kind of interesting point, I think. It just costs an optional donation of £1 to a charity, which I think is a really kind of admirable aspect of this endeavour. Okay, so there's only two things you do when you're an adult and someone opens a grown-ups only ball pit. One is you take your colleagues and have some kind of tenuously justified away day and call it Team Creative Re-energising. Or two, you go and take slow-mo videos of everyone leaping out of the balls like great big whales. And if you want to see some examples of that, just have a look at the Independent article online. It's free to access and you can see some videos of them doing just that.
Yeah.
And the whole thing is totally genius, and because I'm convinced that this does sound like the best thing ever. But I'm not totally convinced that it's actually art, but they have kind of pitched it in that way. It's fundamentally the equivalent of something that indoor play businesses thought up and children have been merrily using for at least 20 years. So I'm wondering if I'm just bitter because it's all booked up and I want to go.
Probably. I think that's definitely a factor. I'm not sure if it's out either.
Yeah.
It's very hard to say. We're not going to have a boring conversation about what is art segment. But it's interesting. And it's interesting that it's done by a company such as the one that you've just told us about. It's the type of company that if you ever met anyone that worked for that company, they would not actually be able to tell you what their job was.
No. But they seem to come up with just genius ideas for things.
I mean, I want to work for a company that is just asks you to come up with a fun idea and let's make it happen and, you know, lounge around in a ball pit for your Friday afternoon. Fantastic. But is it art? I don't think so. I think it's a very fun thing veiled as art, very loosely.
I think it really is interesting they put it in something they've called it a gallery, because it is just a room full of white balls.
And also the fact that, you know, just by changing the colour of something that you already know, is that really art? Is that making something into art?
Do you think making the balls white makes them less fun?
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, somebody used the word serene about it in the article.
There's no way that that's going to be a serene experience.
Well, I just think...
30 people, 30 adults in a ball pit.
If you think about what a ball pit usually is, serene is definitely not...
No!
I think it is kind of fascinating that by just changing the colour, or indeed taking the colour away, they have managed to turn something chaotic and fun into something that is... has been called serene.
That you
I think
can
it's
have
really
business meetings
in. It, apparently, yes. I mean, I'm hoping they extend it because I'm going to make this happen at my work. I know my colleagues would 100% be up for it. So if I actually manage to ever get there, I will, of course, be reporting back on Blackshore Arts Hour.
We would more than enjoy that. Thank you so much, Vicky, for bringing that to our attention. It's such a ridiculous concept.
It is ridiculous, yeah.
Coming up, we've got... Ellie's actually not here this week. She's been my co-host for the last 2 weeks, but as you know, we've got the lovely Vicky in tonight. And Ellie has instead recorded a review of Taken at Midnight, and here it is.
Taken at Midnight has transferred from a successful run at Chichester and is playing for a limited run at the Theatre Royal Haymarket. I went to see it with my sister the week before last. The play is based on the true story of Hans Litten, a German lawyer that represented opponents of the Nazi Party in the late 20s and very early 30s. He actually subpoenaed and cross-examined Adolf Hitler himself in court in 1931. For anyone that knows the history books, not a very shrewd move. By all accounts, it was pretty embarrassing for the Nazi Party. Hitler was made to look like a bit of an idiot on the stand, to say the least. Of course, when the Nazi power then came to power in Germany in 1933, just a couple of years later, Litten was arrested, or as the Nazis termed it then, taken into protective custody. They did this to hundreds of people like Hans Litten, who posed a threat to the Nazi party. In reality, from the moment Hans Litten was taken into protective custody at midnight on the 28th of February 1933, he was imprisoned and tortured. First at Sonnenberg concentration camp and later at Dachau. What sets this production apart from the myriad of films, plays and TV shows about this well-documented period of history is that it's really written from the point of view of Hans Litten's mother, Irmgard, who's played by Penelope Wilton. Seeing the atrocities of the time, told by from the perspective of a mother, and a mother who's in the German upper classes at that, gave a play which could have been heavily political and very dry, a more engaging and human pull. Penelope Wilson herself was fantastic to watch, which I'd expected. I've been a big fan ever since seeing her as Homily in The Borrowers as a kid. The onus is really on her in this production, as she's the active narrator of the story. Huge chunks of the play are Irmgard speaking in direct address to the audience. It was actually very film noir. She does the whole, I'm telling you about the time that I walked into this Nazi officer's office, and he was really well dressed and stirred his tea in this particular way. While, of course, she's walking across the stage, sitting down next to the Nazi officer that she's talking about, while he's stirring his tea in a very particular way and pretending carefully not to be able to hear what she's saying. I think what struck me most about Penelope Wilson's performance is how very still and composed she is. Even when she's angry and frustrated, she's very eloquent, cutting and very carefully paced. We do see some of the action away from Irmgard herself. There are some scenes set in the concentration camps, and this is where I felt the play fell down. Hans Litten shared a cell in Sonnenberg with two other political prisoners, and there were several exchanges which were clearly intended to be light relief. The trouble was, I didn't think they were funny. They were very wordy, the comedy felt very laboured, and I detected a couple of line drops. They were swiftly covered, and maybe no one else noticed, while I say that in the post-show discussion, between myself and my sister, she confessed that she'd noticed too. One of Litten's cellmates, Pip Donaghy, played Eric Moussam, and he deserves special mention. I could see that he was really a very gifted character actor, and some of his more physical clowning caused me to crack a smile. I'm not sure if it was Jonathan Church's direction or Mark Hayhurst's writing that was at fault here, or maybe there just wasn't enough chemistry between the prison mates. I confess, it felt as though the director had enjoyed working on some scenes more than others, and the comedy just felt neglected. Comedy is so important in plays like this. I always feel a tragedy much harder if I've been laughing moments before. And more to the point, the comedy here was a real chance for the audience to connect with Hans Litten personally. Martin Hudson gives a very competent performance as Hans, but he's a slightly awkward character. He's highly intelligent, strong-willed, and naturally quite quiet, and it's really easy for him to feel distant and even slightly uninteresting at times to the audience. I know vast numbers will disagree with me on this, and this production has been given absolutely rave 4- and 5-star reviews from the main papers, so maybe it was a bad show night that I saw it. There are always good shows and bad shows in any run, and it's worth noting that I saw it in preview week. It's also worth mentioning that the set was fantastic. Designed by Robert Jones, it was clean, simple and super effective. It was all set on a perspective cheating angle, which felt very enclosed and overpowering. And with the Nazi concentration camp set at the back, there was a huge set of double doors for the Nazis' office and various other locations downstage. For me, it was a big tick for the subject matter, the set and individual performances, but there were awkward or neglected moments which brought me out of the story, and I found it really hard to connect with any of the characters. It's definitely worth a watch, and I'd give it 3 stars. It's running at the Theatre Royal Haymarket until the 14th of March.
That was our lovely Ellie Pitkin's review of Taken at Midnight. This has been the Black Shore Arts Hour, and we're nearly out of time on this Sunday evening. Vix is gonna sort of tell you all how you can get in contact with us.
So if you are in Wandsworth, in London, anywhere, and you've got an arts thing going on and you think we should be covering it on this show, or you want to come in and talk to us about it, or you want to give us a recording of something that you've done, then please, please, please get in touch with us. We'd love to hear about what you're doing. You can find details of how to contact us at www.blackshoreonline.com. You can tweet us at Blackshore Update. Please do follow us on Twitter for information about things, very exciting things that we've got coming up on Blackshore Arts Hour in the future. And you can like us on Facebook. It's Blackshore Online, and you'll be able to find us there on Facebook. So please do hunt us down, email us, get in touch, whatever you want to do. Carrier pigeon probably will work.
Send us your arts things. I like that we've just decided that they're just arts things.
Arts things. Arts things is the new phrase that I'm using to describe all of the arts.
The Blackshore Arts Hour with all the arts things.
Yeah, nothing is excluded. This week we've had poetry, we've talked about movies, we've talked about ball pits, but it can be anything if it's arts, and even if it's really only tenuously linked to arts, we're still interested.
Exactly. So coming up next week on the show, I'm going to be talking to Marcus Baisley, who is the director of a new production coming up. It's called Great Expectations. So there'll be an interview with him. Matt's going to be back in the studio because he's a legend, and he's probably going to be talking about a film.
Yeah.
Would that be correct?
I expect you
are the film guy.
Yeah. Tweet me at Matt Boothman. Tell me, should I see Big Hero 6, Inherent Vice, or Kingsman?
I say Kingsman. Let's have Kingsman.
Yeah, we should have some kind of Twitter voting system.
Yeah, that would be good.
You've got to let me know early in the week, though, so I can...
Oh, yeah, that's true. You have to tell Matt by tomorrow.
Yes, we need all those answers on a Monday so that Matt can plan his week in accordance. We're gonna leave you now with a song by Hozier called From Eden. I've been Aisha. I've had Vicky and Matt in the studio with me this evening. It's been lovely, and we will see you next week.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.